Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Well, good evening and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. My pleasure to be with you. We have both Kirk and JB this evening. And fellas, I have both something I thought was fairly inspiring that I learned yesterday, confirmed this morning, and my ongoing translations. And I also have a bit of melancholy news. And one of the things I did here about 6 weeks ago, maybe 8 weeks ago, as I shared that, you know, I've had some challenges post-divorce, that, you know, fractured kind of family things, some just aches and pains. And had another one here recently. I finally got an offer to buy the farm that's the last piece of joint property between my ex and I, and she just went. Flipped her lid, and what she said to the realtor and the like on not willing to accept the offer. And so I found out how difficult it is, the long process it is to get the judge to intervene to create a resolution. And that is quite frustrating. But one of the things that was really positive is after I shared some of that, I've received just a lot of letters from covenant members, all saying the same thing. You know, it's nice to know we're not alone. That our earthly families are terribly fractured, and that's in contrast to the covenant family. And matter of fact, what I was translating today is in the third psalm, the third mizmor, and the third mizmor is. It's attributed to Dode's response to Absalom. Although it, in the parts I've translated so far, there's no mention of Absalom's name. But you guys familiar with the episode of Absalom?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, talk about a fractured family. You know, Dode's eldest son rapes his daughter. And Dode doesn't do anything about it. And so Absalom is his sister that is raped, Dode's third-born son. He hightails it out of town to protect his sister. And while he's there, he's kind of scheming as how he's going to get back at Dode for allowing this to happen to her. And he ends up... playing politician and telling all the people that come to have an audience with Dode that, hey man, if I was judge, you know, I'd give you, it'd be a Cadillac in every driveway and, you know, a chicken in every pot and, you know, it's the essential. I'll promise you, I'll give you what is not yours to take by offering what is not mine to give. And the people say, yeah, well, that's great. Yeah, that's what we want. You know, mankind hasn't changed much over the years. He gets quite the following. So he pronounces him, Absalom to buy some time. Brings his troops together, and they go after Absalom, who's declared himself king of what Yahweh has given to Dod, and they get him, and they defeat him, in the process, Absalom gets riding an ass, and he gets his hair caught in a gadol Allah. And that would be Almighty Allah. And Dod's commander, who is Joab, meaning Yahweh is the father, kills him. And Dod is just grief-stricken. He's, oh my God, Absalom, my son, oh my God. And he's just pining over the son's death. And then his commander hears of this, the man that killed his son, and walks in to Dod, and he says, you are surrounded by people that you're pretending like they don't even exist, that would have died saving your life, saving your son's life, saving your daughter's lives, saving your wife's life. They didn't even die saving your concubine's lives. And here you are thanking them by wringing your eyes out over the person that led this coup. What the hell's wrong with you? You love what you should hate, and you hate what you should love. That's what he tells them. You love what you should hate, and you hate what you should love. Well, I'm ever glad that I opened observations with our time with hate is a virtue. Mm-hmm. What a strong statement. And he said, if you don't get up right now and go out and speak to the people from the heart, then you're going to endure more evil than you have since the day you were born up to this point. Amazing speech. And it's essentially this commander speaking for Yahweh. In fact, the guy even begins the speech by saying, you're just like decrepitated and withered. What happened to you? So Dod has some family issues. He had issues with wives, issues with sons, issues with daughters. And so here's the wisest man that ever lived, the man who is more beloved by God than probably the rest of us combined. And he too had family problems. And that does lead to something we'll talk about in a future program, because we're going to talk a lot about Moab and the conditions at Sodom. But as I was translating the second Mizmor, something became apparent that was only answerable one way. And then as I'm dealing with the third Mizmor, it becomes undeniable. And that is that I've been wrong all this time in denying a second coming. There is going to be a second coming. It's just the wrong Messiah is being attributed to the second coming. So we're going to go through that and examine how the second and third Mizmor, which are just riveting. In fact, as we go through the second Mizmor, it begins with God questioning the whole concept of conspiracy. He said, what in the world's wrong with you? Why in the world would you promote these conspiracies? And we're going to talk about the origin of the ultimate conspiracy, which is blame the Jews, and how that conspiracy was made forefront, made the most popular and longest enduring conspiracy of all time by no other than Paul. And we're going to examine the most damning and deadly of all of the Blame the Jews conspiracies. I did a real thorough analysis on the genesis of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, how it came to be, who promoted it, what texts were plagiarized. authorized to create it. And in doing so, really uncovered some, it's just wow material. And we'll even go into how one of the players in that was a major player in the Marie Antoinette conspiracies. Most people don't even know that the French Revolution was based on a conspiracy, and it's a very similar conspiracy to the these Blame the Jews conspiracies.
Really?
Just leave you with a teaser. What is Marie Antoinette's most famous line?
Let them eat cake. They have no bread.
Yeah. Guess what? She never
said it.
Never said it.
Enough. Good line.
No, she just never said it. No, not probably not. She never said it. In fact, all of the grievances that were used to turn the people against Marie Antoinette not only were not true, the opposite of what the claimants were saying was true. And, of course, the claimants here were the Jacobins. And the Jacobins are the outgrowth of Adam Weishaupt's socialist secular humanist mantra, where he wanted to bring down the Roman Catholic Church and to diminish their authority in being able to establish kings in Europe. Yeah, the whole thing was a lie. I have no idea whether or not she was a good person or a bad person. I can just tell you that all the claims against her, including that line, were fabricated, and deliberately so. So we're going to talk about how destructive and deadly conspiracies can be, because that's the essence of the second mizmor, is a conspiracy. All right, we're going to return right now to Lot and the conditions in Sodom. Now that we've thrown out the T's of the second coming, but with the wrong Messiah, or the right Messiah, but the wrong one from the view of Christians. This is what preceded the passage we were on. And they called out to Lot, the one wrapped too tightly, who was encircled, encased, and entangled. And they said to him, where are the individuals who, to show the way to the relationship, came to you this night? Choose to bring them out to us, such that we can fulfill our desire to be acquainted with them. Why, yada, f him, so that we can choose to become familiar with them, to understand them, to discover what can be known about them, even to make ourselves known to them. This is followed by, and so Lot, the enveloped and entangled, went out to them at the doorway, shutting the door after him, and said, please, no, certainly not. I beg you, my brothers, this is bad. This is disturbing. This is distressful. This is troubling. This is harmful. This is destructive. Wrong. Ra'ah. That leads us to the passage that is just so twisted and misunderstood, but so interesting that we're going to spend some time on it. Now I beg you, please, Henana, for contrast, consider my, this is La'ani, two daughters, Shanaim, Bath, who, to reveal the way, have not known a man and are unfamiliar and unacquainted with ignorant men. Asher, Lo Yada, Ish, who, to reveal the proper and narrow, restrictive path to walk, to engage in life in a beneficial relationship, do not respect, nor do they acknowledge, are not concerned with, nor do they know or choose, thereby remaining unresponsive. I want to bring them out. Yet, of my own volition, is my desire to produce and extend them, to bring an end to this and to finish it right now. Nah. Raw and in the flesh as an exhortation, a way of making a point by heightening the sense of urgency. With them, livening the narrative and calling attention to these details, F. Henna. Do to them, engaging and acting as you desire, whatever you'd like to do concerning them, consistent with, according to, whatever you find good, moral, and beneficial in your eyes. So you can do whatever you want, so long as it is good, moral, and beneficial from your perspective. What you find productive, useful, and decent in your sight. Pleasing, pleasant, effective, and generous from your perspective, and even desirable and virtuous based upon your viewpoint. And only exclusively, applying a single restriction and prerequisite, making an exception. Nevertheless, with this distinction, regarding these individuals, to them, do not engage by making a statement, by communicating a message, Dabar, by saying something, by making a pronouncement, by offering an account or declaration, because and for the express reason they have come into the shadow of my support structure. Now that is not the message you get out reading the King James, is it?
Hardly.
And the problem with that is that with the King James, no has been turned into yada, has burned into yada, have sex with them. The Malak were introduced as male, and there were all males outside the door, so that turned into homosexual sex with them. But that's not what's being talked about at all. Yada doesn't mean to have sex. When Yahweh wants to talk about sex, he will use the verb bo, come into. And he'll even add it, as he does when Lot's daughters get their father drunk and have sex with him. Lie with them and then bo. It's not yada. So we're in a situation here where it's really important to have perspective. First thing you can say on perspective is, just as Abraham knew that Yahweh, as his heavenly father, we talked about this last week, loved Yitzhak even more than he did, he wasn't about to let anyone take the life of the first child of the covenant. Abraham was safe. He knew it. He could go out and play this whole thing out, and he knew that Yahweh would come up with a resolution. Same thing was true with the two Malak sitting there in Doe's house. Nothing was going to happen to his daughters, and he knew it. Now, our first clue in this process of trying to understand what's really happening here is, and moving past the implausible, which is, hey, how about my daughters, to the sublime, which is, my daughters are being offered to you as a contrast to your own thinking. Please know, certainly not, I beg you, my brothers, this is bad. This is disturbing and distressful, troubling and harmful, ruinous and destructive. Having their way with his daughters and man's was man's way. And Lot knew that man's way was evil. Further, he was aware, and so should we be, that man's way is reflected in his religious beliefs, his political views, his social conditioning, family values. These things are all on display during this dark night. And our second clue is found in the preposition law, which in this case is rendered consider by way of contrast. The third insight related to the first, because Lot, knowing that they would not listen to reason, realizing that they wouldn't recognize the truth if it was presented to them on a silver platter, offered them this mirror. Asher lo yada ish. Revealing that the way of man could be visible if they would just weren't so naive. If they were willing to consider how unaware and indeed ignorant they really were by making the comparison of Lot's girls who were really ignorant. Beyond this comparison was also the stunning contrast of recognizing that Asher lo yada infers that Lot's daughters had rejected the ways of men. They were unacquainted with human stupidity. Our fourth insight comes from the verb yasa, bring out, which indicates that in this narrative. Let's call everyone's attention to the details. Listen closely. Pay close attention. That's Athena. He's encouraging us to do what we're doing now. We're doing something that has, you know, hasn't been done in the past 3,000 years. Closely observing. Closely examining. Carefully considering every possible explanation. Every single detail. Every word and letter. You know, truth is found in the details. Six, the presentation was to encourage the riotous and unruly rubbish outside the home to be introspective, to actually think before they acted. Now, he put constraints on them. What they could do was limited to that which was Tob. Tob is the Hebrew word for good. Not bad. But even these goons knew that rape was bad. And they were limited to that which was moral and beneficial, productive and decent, useful and effective, generous and pleasing, even virtuous. Hard to wiggle rape in the midst of that.
Yeah.
And by the way, how could, just think of it for a moment, you know, the Christian view is they were really bad because they were homosexuals. That's why God torched Sodom and Gomorrah. They were homosexuals. Well, if they were homosexuals, what's the purpose of offering the daughters?
Yeah.
Anybody ever stop to think of that? You can't have it both ways. Yeah, don't confuse me with the facts.
Yeah.
The second clue is rock. Rock means there's a limitation, there's a restriction, there's an exception. Rock is extraordinarily exclusive. In fact, just before the program, Kirk and I talked about rock because if you look up rock and Strong's, Strong's based on the King James doesn't give you enough to even get out of your own shadow on rock. The King James defines it as thin and lean, and then not but, except but, only altogether surely, only not altogether, save except, or spitting and spittle.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for playing, but I just, you know, I'm looking at 15 different lexicons here. First one is rock, only. Nevertheless, next one is except. Besides, those are restrictions. Then only, but you go to the to our favorite, which is the BDL. It means only, exclusively, pertaining to that which is unique and distinctive, sometimes implying a restriction. In a single fact or incidence, except, however, nevertheless, involving a contrast, emphasizing an exception. So, except you can't do this. There's one thing you can't do. Now, are you guys aware of any place that there is a prerequisite or an exception where God says, you know, before we begin here, there's one thing you can't do.
And there's this stone. It's got a whole three of them.
Yeah. Yeah. The first thing you better do is you better
walk away.
Walk away. Walk away from Babel, from your country, from religion, from politics, from your father's house, from societal customs. You can't bring that stuff in here. That's a restriction. It's a rock. Well, that's a wolf. The most valuable and important offer ever made is rock, extraordinarily exclusive because there is a prerequisite only one in a million like those surrounding Doe's home are willing to accept. Further, rock is actually an adverb indicating that it's modifying the action, or in this case, the inaction, which follows Lot's loan restriction. Now, this leads us to our eighth clip. By the way, I still am intrigued by spittle and how to work that into the translation. often you get to work spittle into a translation. This leads us to our eighth clue, which was the negation of Asha. Asha means to do. When it's negated, it means do nothing. When addressing a relationship or an agreement, as in the case here, it means do not engage in it, do not act upon it. Since Asha was nullified regarding the Malak, it means that Sodom's depraved souls were being excluded from acting upon the agreement proposed by the one who sent them and precluded them from engaging in a relationship with him. God is simply didn't want these religious buffoons to be part of his family. So, no, there was this restriction. Do nothing. You can't engage. You know, God wasn't there to. There is no hint whatsoever that God was there to save Sodom. He wasn't trying to get him to repent.
No. Very clear what his was there for.
Yeah. He realized they were too far gone. They were just going to destroy him. There is no call for humanity to repent before Yahweh returns. Yeah, they were there to destroy it. There to destroy it. In this regard, our ninth insight is very subtle. It's found in the string of prepositions, ba, la, el. The definite articles, ha, the pronouns, ish, and the nouns, ish, and the pronouns, el, which precede and follow Lot's adverb and verb. Lot is being abnormally careful in identifying what can and can't be done and to whom. The tenth clue is the one virtually everyone misses because it is hideously twisted and misrepresented in English Bible translations. These lustful libertines were not being prevented from raping the Malak, something they couldn't do anyway. They were being precluded from something they otherwise would be able to do, speak to them. There is nothing about Dabar that means sex. Dabar is not only the Hebrew word for word. It means to speak, to make a statement, to communicate a message, to convey an idea, to dictate an order, or to issue a pronouncement. Lot didn't want Sodom's mental midgets blathering any of their idiotic conspiratorial ideas, their political platitudes, their religious beliefs, their societal customs, or their moral mantras to the Malak. He didn't want to hear it.
I don't know how every English translation took the bar and turned it into deeds or actions.
Right.
Nothing about that word implies any of that.
As a matter of fact, the verb preceding it speaks of inaction. Do nothing. The negation of Anna is do nothing.
You know what else I found?
What?
I also found that it's an epidemic, a disease affecting animals and man, a pestilence. It's a plague as an act. So in essence, what he's saying, or what I found, is that he's saying to him, don't share your ideas, don't share your pronouncements, your diseased epidemics, your plague. Sound like Paul,
yeah.
Just like Paul. Don't share that. They don't want to hear all your crap.
Right.
And so
they don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. God doesn't want to hear it. They don't want to hear it. Nobody wants to hear it.
And that's all.
So I was just telling you, the one thing that I'm prohibiting here is in my house where you're under the protection of my support structure. We're not going to hear it. Go away if that's what you want to do.
Well, isn't that what God always says? I mean, there's been 10 billion people probably on the earth. If he wanted to hang out with all these people that are religious and political and everything, and military, he could have chosen anybody he wanted to. But and even the Yehudim, when they go religious, he says, get out of here. Go to Babylon if that's what you want to do. I mean, the message is bringing out constantly.
Yeah. Exactly. If somebody who was political was acceptable to you, if somebody who was religious was acceptable to you, if somebody who was patriotic and militaristic was acceptable to Yahweh, if somebody who was conspiratorial was acceptable to Yahweh, do you think Yahweh would say, that for 2,000 years I looked for somebody with whom I could work and found no one.
Hardly.
You know, there's like 20 billion people he'd have found if that was okay, right?
Yeah. It's just common sense.
Why did he tap Abram on the shoulder and not all of the really smart people in Sumai and Assyria and Babylon?
He walked away to start with.
Because he walked away. Why did he come to Moshe?
He walked away too.
He walked away. Why did he come and tap old Noach on the shoulder and say, "Hey, man, bad stuff's coming. Don't
go living in town."
He walked away.
So did you.
Every time that Yoshua was confronted by a whole bunch of people, after he would deal with maybe one, and then what did he do after that? Answer one question, and then what did he do? Every time.
So
he walked away.
Yeah,
he just walked away. I was reading when I was a Christian. I said, why is he doing that? You know, he's only going to be here for 3 years. Why is he engaging everybody? Why is he trying to save everybody? Why is he presenting the message of salvation?
So well.
But he wasn't. He just walked away. Over and over and over again.
It is astounding, isn't it?
So, God doesn't want to hear it. That's just all there is to it. As you said, JB, you can search every translation. There isn't a single translation that renders the bar even remotely accurately. Yes.
They act like it's not even there. Like, I looked up, I have one, and I use it for a quick reference. It's the KJV Plus, and it's basically KJV with Strong's link next to everything. And, yeah, it puts it in there with the word right before, and it translates it as, like the translation, that these two words together mean this. And it's like, no. You can see it on the bar. Nothing about that means action, deed, anything like that. You just completely ignored it and said, oh, well, when it's with this word, we don't, it just means deed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we are not the sharpest three people in the history of humankind. And we found it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, we just looked it up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And how much were we paid collectively to find this?
Nothing.
And you've got all these people who throughout time have worked for all these religious institutions. I've been paid all of this money to do this, and not one of them said, "Hey, boys, the bar is one of the top 10 words in the whole of the Hebrew lexicon. We ought not just ignore it." Yeah, but how are you going to rail against homosexuality if the restriction is?
It doesn't fit the narrative they created for themselves.
Right.
They decided what this means, and then they translated it to mean what they wanted it to say.
Yeah. No. I may be a tad smarter than the average mutt, but I'm infinitely dumber than God. Our relationship works much better when I listen before I respond. And truthfully, my response to what Yahweh is telling us is almost always found in these words, words which celebrate his words. You know, we all, Shama and Shamar, his Dabanim, and then come to Yada and be in his message. And only then do we Amar about his Dabanim. And I laugh sometimes, okay, well, I'm bored, I'm going to be an hypocrite here because I have a propensity to be verbose, but my comments, my enthusiasm is prolific and passionate, largely because his testimony is so enlightening and enriching, so expansive, so revealing. My motivation is to share the insights derived from being a good listener, being especially observant. That said, the point I was making here is, at least through Lot, is that the combined wisdom of Sodom, its collective voice, the sum of all their opinions and ideals, the full variety of their religious beliefs, the totality of their conspiratorial notions, the expansive array of their political, military, not that God doesn't care about the ways of man. It's that he's overtly and demonstrably hostile to them. Now, if I'm correct in my calculus, and I've read ahead, so I've cheated here, and I can tell you that I am. Sodom equals Moab equals Tabel Adam. Man's world is, as it is, influenced by socialist, secular humanism, multiculturalism, and Pauline Christianity. And while that defines Moab, we are going to be told explicitly that Moab and Sodom are one and the same. If you understand the modern manifestation of Moab, just consider Sodom. And what you're seeing in Sodom is not homosexuality, but belligerent and wrong ideas, a conspiracy of you're trying to influence us a lot. Move out of the way. It's best that you get out of our hair. We don't like you here. You can't judge us. Them being unruly, unreceptive. But it's one of the things that is difficult for most people to understand is how you could have a mix of Pauline Christianity and socialist secular humanism. I say those things are opposites. I'm going to say, no, they're not at all. In fact, Christianity today exists in the West in the milieu of political correctness. In fact, there's almost no Christianity today outside of political correctness and socialist secular humanism. Socialist secular humanism has become the religion of academia. And you have almost no one that hasn't been indoctrinated in it, influenced by it. But more than this, and we're going to examine Paul's most influential words. Paul is also the author of multicultural socialist secular humanism, just as he is the religion of Pauline Christianity. And we're going to see they have the same author. Now, today, human jabbering, what these boys wanted to do in Sodom, and let's understand, this is the seminal statement here. And so they wanted to have their way. They wanted to be able to say whatever they wanted to say to these messengers. It wasn't, the restriction was you can't listen to them. The restriction was you can't talk to them. And that's the thing that they railed against. So look at today in terms of yabbering. There is a seemingly endless number of television stations and radio stations, most conveying nonsense. There are more smartphones than smart people, with very little said that has any merit. The internet is almost everywhere, enabling social media sites like Facebook, WhatsApp, WeChat, QQ, Qzone, Tumblr, Instagram, Twitter, G+, Lunkin, Vimeo, Skype, Flickr, Viber. I'm sure you're right with me, Kirk, on all of this. Line, Snapchat, YY, Telegram, Reddit. You know that everyone I just mentioned there has over 100 million users worldwide. There are countless churches, mosques, and temples, innumerable political rostrums, and 7 billion bozos babbling BS. Little wonder God has had more than is enough of our opinions. Unless it is to accept the 5 terms and conditions of his Bereth covenant, to accept his 7 Mikra invitations to meet, or to express our appreciation for his Torah guidance, zip it. Now, I'm probably a little bit stiff on that in the sense that I'm aware for all of us that there are times where things got to be tough and we needed, we wanted, we'd appreciate some help. And we've opened up to Yah and seen a positive response. But even then, we're cognizant that we don't ask for things that are outside of what is believe, come from the words Tezel. Tezel means shadow. And yet this was occurring in the middle of the night. Tezel means shadow, and this was occurring in the middle of the night. So he's not talking about them coming under the shadow of his support structure. But that's not all that the Tezel means. A shadow is a two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional object. Adam was introduced, and we're told that with a nefesh conscience, or consciousness, and a nesama conscience, he was created in Yahweh's Tezelim, image. So, what we're hearing here is that there is a representation of something very special that is within the timbers, within the support structure, with the malak inside of Lotom. It says, when they're inside of this representation of the symbolism of what this doorway and home represents in my family, that it's under those auspices of those things that you can't talk to them. Therefore, by using a diminutive variation of Tezelim, or Tezel, Lot was comparing his abode with his uncle's home, with his uncle Abraham's dwelling, with the covenant here on earth. And that contrasted to living with God during the millennial Sukkah Shabbat, which is but a foreshadow of life in heaven in the seventh dimension. These are all images of one another. And that leaves us with a final word in this compelling statement. Kirk, you probably had a field day with this. It's one of the toughest to translate because it's used very infrequently. And it's rendered roof in most English Bibles, but the Hebrew word for roof is actually gak. And this is Q-O-W-R-A-H. It's not only doesn't have two G's, it doesn't even have one. You know, Korah describes the load-bearing timber works, the beams, the support structure, the joists, the rafters of a home. A Korah can also be a thick plank or a sturdy pole used vertically in construction, especially an upright pillar holding up a roof. If Lot were speaking of the tabernacle of the witness, the upright pillar in its center, the one carrying the entire load of the tent, is an Edon, a term that is used to describe Yahweh. But since this was an insignificant home in a perverse community, Lot's use of Korah to say that his house was a Tezel, a tiny manifestation, a mere reflection of the covenant. In Paleo Hebrew, this is what I came up with as I tried to play Kirk, is that the Q is perspective, proper perspective. The wa is that the tent pole means that this is a the perspective that is grounded and secure. The ra is an observant and thoughtful individual. And the hey is someone looking up, standing up, reaching up.
Reaching up, yeah.
Good. Yeah, so this is a structure that's a proper support structure. The symbolism is, from the proper perspective, one who is grounded and secure, such an individual is observant and thoughtful, looking up, standing up, and reaching up to God. I like that better than the support structure.
That's very good. Very good. Am I out of a job now?
No, I knew that you were blind these past months, so I figured I'd better.
Well, that's very good.
I better pitch in.
You're very good. I got real close, so that's good.
What did you come up with as you?
Oh, it's the same thing. I look at it as perspective. We're looking towards the horizon, and increase, but the increase is predicated on the anchor. You know, that it has to be anchored. You can't increase. You're not going to enlarge the family unless they're anchored in the family.
Mm-hmm. And wall means to enlarge or to add to.
Enlarge the tent, certainly in tent peg. And so mm-hmm. you had the anchor. And you had the roach, which is obviously the not only a thoughtful person because they're observing, but also they're looking in the correct direction going from right to left. Towards.
Oh, yeah.
The ultimate position is, of course, when you're standing with Yah. You're standing up, looking up, reaching out to him. So, yes.
Yeah, typically if a letter is leaning away from a letter in Yahweh's name, we're in trouble. It's negative. And if it's looking towards or leaning towards a letter in Yahweh's name, it's beneficial. The Rosh was put between the letter that's replicated twice, the A, and the Waw. So it gets favorable, even though its back is to the Waw, because it's facing the two A's.
That's the way I would look
right
at it.
So it still gets the favorable nod. That was one of the most insightful things I think I've ever heard, is that if you want to know why two words or a word can be rendered negatively when other words are rendered positively with the same letters, it's depending on which one of the letters, which are more than half of them, have a direction or lean. And if they're leaning towards or away from, in this case, looking towards or away from with the Rosh, letters that are in Yahweh's name.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
I don't think anybody has been motivated to check that out, much less come to that conclusion, Kirk, in the 6,000 years that we have been on this planet and had the opportunity to know. Yeah, so that's that was pretty extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, thanks. That's pretty cool. It all came, Yahweh does that for you, if you look.
Yeah.
He just says, look,
all you got to do is be willing to invest the time and be passionate about going where the words lead, or in this case, the letters. Now, if I may interrupt this presentation with a special announcement. Dear Homo sapiens, Sodom isn't the lurid story of God's retribution against homosexuals. It is instead his vivid portrayal of what happens to those who reject his Torah guidance, when it conflicts with their faith, with their politics, with their values, and with the way they want to live their lives, and who resort to ad hominem fallacy to demean the messenger rather than processing the message. Beyond the realization that this is what is happening here in Sodom, by referring to Lot as someone who Shaphat, who was passing judgment on them, which is what we're going to read here in just a moment, I think my assessment of the story is vindicated. Sodom is not a referendum on gang rape or homosexuality, but instead an expose on values and on the difference between what God values and what man desires. The Sodomites wanted the opportunity to speak with Yahweh's messengers, to share their beliefs and opinions with the Moloch, and Lot was preventing them from doing so, for all the reasons we have discussed. The mob outside of Lot's door had become an obstacle, and worse, someone they saw trying to profit from his situation. So they viewed this whole episode this way, because it was far easier for the Sodomites to demean and discredit the man who stood in their way, the man who had just told them that they were wrong, than it was for them to prevail on the merits of their ideas. Mentally bankrupt, they blamed Lot for their impoverished condition, rather than enrich themselves through this opportunity. Had they responded appropriately, the Moloch would have come out and spoken to them just as the Moloch had engaged with Lot. Now, such is the way of all of those who fancy their religion, politics, and conspiracy. So they responded and said, step forward, because it would be best if you choose to move out of the way as you're trying to exploit us. Nagash, Halah, come off of there right now, even though you seem to believe that you're in a position to extract payment and cause trouble. trouble. So therefore, and henceforth, of your own volition, broaden your thinking such that it is in compliance with us, as all this pertains to a future time and place, a great distance away. Wow. What's the most enduring, most destructive, and deadly conspiracy of all time?
Well, the Jews.
The Jews are trying to exploit us. Yes, indeed. Those who would claim to have a heritage from Abraham, you're trying to exploit us.
How so?
I'm writing the first chapter of the second volume of Observations for a Time, and because the second Mizmor of Saul, I'm beginning this by laying out this committee order we're going to follow, and we're going to go through the first seven Mizmor, and then after we do the first seven Mizmor, we're going to go into Yirmiyah 48 through 51, which covers a lot of the same ground we just were in with Yaseyah. But add some insights and perspectives that really help us understand and put the whole pieces together and really understand the role that Babylon plays in all of this. And as I was doing that, of course, the second Mizmor is all about conspiracy. Oh, that's where it begins anyway, it's conspiracy. And it was evident that the conspiracy that God's most hateful of is the one that's the most popular. Blame the Jews. So as I mentioned in the beginning of this program, I devoted days to studying everything that I could learn about the elders of the protocols of the elders of Zion. Who conceived it, from where they derived their myth, how obvious it was that what they were written was plagiarized and untrue, how quickly it was discovered that it was a fraud. And yet, there are countless, very popular conspirators that convey it today as it was true. You know, during Nasser's Egypt, it was the most popular book in distribution. It was the first 500,000 copies were distributed by the most successful American entrepreneur of all time. Henry Ford. Yep. And yet, it was immediately obvious that it was untrue. The guy that did the most to promote it in America actually was a Roman Catholic priest who was the first radio and television evangelist. And we'll cover his story as well. But David Icke is a fellow today who went to dinner in a Greek restaurant. There's a Russian there at the Greek restaurant that was saying that the person that he's most impressed with, the person who he follows, is David Icke. David Icke is the foremost conspirator on the reptilian overlords. Are you guys familiar with that conspiracy? He is the number one advocate of the reptilian overlords. And he, of course, is an anti-Semite and claims that the protocols of the Elders of Zion is true. But it really records secret meetings of Jews and their plans to overcome the earth. You know what's striking to me, though, about this conspiracy is that if we were to look for the last 2,000 years, and I were to give you the fastest computers in the world, the best access to the best research in the world, I'm not sure you could come up with a single example of Jews scheming together to do in non-Jews.
They don't even try and convert them. They just don't care.
No, they're not even trying to convert them. And yet, the number of times through the pogroms and the Warsaw ghetto and the Holocaust, what's happening today with Muslims against Israel, with their acts of terrorism, the number of times that non-Jews have sought to annihilate in genocidal fashion Jews is probably more prolific than any other race has ever endured. So it's the opposite of what the conspiracy claims is true.
So why is
the most enduring?
I mean, how do they get that to fly? I mean,
it is just stunning how you would get that to fly. It's in essence to say that Jews are the dumbest people on earth because they've been plotting this for 2,000 years, and so far they haven't accomplished a single act in accordance with it, not one. And by the way, they're the greatest victim of the of acts to the contrary. It's amazing how stupid people are. It's like, you know what...
I don't think I share someone who's that incompetent.
Very good.
It would be best if you choose to move out of the way as you're trying to exploit us. And all this charge is prophetic. It foreshadows the most prolific, debilitating, anti-Semitic conspiracy ever promoted by man. It would serve as the inspiration for the anti-Semitic perversion known as the Protocols for the Elders of Zion, as the catalyst of the Holocaust. It's best, Jews, that you step out of our way because you're trying to exploit us. The myth has been repeated so shrilly and so frequently that it's become ingrained as a cancerous cell in Christians, Muslims, socialists, and conspirators. This notion that Jews run the world and that they do so as part of a plot to enrich themselves by exploiting everyone else. Boy, why is it that Israel is trying to cling to this little tiny stretch of dirt that no one even wanted? I mean, it was essentially abandoned.
In a barren wasteland.
Yeah.
Read Mark Twain.
That's all they can do.
Yeah.
That's a whole lot less than American influence, or Russian, or British, or French, or Japanese. Yeah. Heck, the Mongols did better.
Basically, as big as the Emperor.
Yeah. You know, this was the malignancy that emerged in Imperial Rome 2,000 years ago and metastasized in the Roman Catholic Church and then in the Third Reich. But because to be anti-Semitic is to be against their Shem name, Yahud, the beloved of Yahweh, their prophetic message, the Torah, the Navi, and the Mizmor, even the Mashiach and Yisrael, there is no more destructive or deadly conspiracy in the history of mankind. From Vespasian and Titus to Hadrian and Nero. From Constantine and Theodosius to Pope Pius XII and Adolf Hitler. Even running through Paul and Muhammad along the way, this would all lead to the diaspora, to expelling Jews from their homes, to expelling them from where they were taken, and to burning Jews by the millions in furnaces. The worst conspiracy man ever concocted has been laid out for us to contemplate. The man related by ethnicity to Abraham was told, step forward, because it would be best if you choose to move out of the way as you're trying to exploit us. Come off of there right now, even though you seem to believe that you're in a position to extract a payment and cause us trouble. Henceforth, broaden your thinking such that it is in compliance with us, and with us recognizing that this all pertains to a future time and place, a great distance away from the days of Sodom, 4,000 years ago. They went on to say, this one, the king of Lot, came, arrived, to live as a guest, as a stranger, Lot Gur, and now he has become the judge, making the decisions and passing judgment, Shaphat Shaphat. So now it seems appropriate that we make you suffer along with them. Then they insisted, they applied pressure, and they demanded their own way against the individual, very severely against Lot. And they approached to break down the door. Isn't that it? This one, he arrived as a guest of a stranger, but now he's become our judge. They didn't want to deal with what Lot had to say. They had hominem argument. What right do you have to judge us? You can't pass judgment on us.
Well,
you're not one of us. America, love it or leave it.
Yeah.
Just go away. And, you know, I just every time I think about this, I goofed. I went to a football game in Texas. And normally, I'm anticipating the arrival of the flag of the national anthem, and I'm out to head to the restroom. But unfortunately, they were walking in with the flag, and it was still a minute or two before the national anthem, and I started to leave, and the Nimrods there in Texas, man, said, where do you think you're going? You know, stand
really?
Here. Pay attention. Oh, yeah.
I'm going to the bathroom.
Tell them
yeah.
I'm old. I have to
no.
go.
No. Yeah. Yeah, if you walk past us, we're going to make you suffer.
Really?
Yeah.
I believe it. Son of a S.O.B., son of Baal.
Son of Baal. And they insisted and they put on pressure. They demanded their own way. Remember I said that it was obvious that the whole issue with Sodom is that they were demanding their own way. They wanted to give the Moloch an earful of their way. You know, as pray people, the Christians, to get down on their knees and pray before their bedtime. Oh God, you know, protect my country and do this for Aunt Susie and do that. Oh, dictating what God ought to do. God didn't want to hear it. So they approached to break down the door. Guess what they couldn't do?
Get inside.
But get through that door. Yeah, that door represents peace. Actually, no way they're getting in that door. That door represents heaven. That door represents salvation. They aren't getting through that door. It could have been the entire town, folk. They aren't getting through that door. Well, the best this mistaken imbeciles had to offer was get out of our way. You're not like us, so you can't judge us. Because you tried to reason with us, we're going to make you suffer. And they rushed the door. Gang mentality in the land of midgets. Now, this is exactly what I've experienced. I think you all have. As I've exposed and condemned our religion, political, military, economic, social, and conspiratorial myths. Those who believe them, those who define themselves by them, especially those who are prone to promote them, begin by claiming that I have no right to judge them, followed by the notion that I'm unqualified to judge them or their beliefs, even though I typically know far more about the basis of those myths than they do. Then, rather than deal with anything I've shared, those lost in the world of religion and politics, of patriotism and conspiracy, they try to make me suffer, posting all manner of tripe and slander on social media. You know, I did six or seven interviews here recently, and what I came to experience is that the world has changed a lot since I was doing six or seven of these a day. And during the years where I was doing six or seven a day, it was few and far between that I would find somebody that would use this kind of an ad hominem argument. But as I did these seven interviews, almost everyone responded with the ad hominem argument. It's a fallacy.
Only land they got, probably.
Yeah, and they're far more willing to wield the fallacy than ever before. This is our Moab today. You have no right to judge us. We'll make you suffer. You know, that's part of the 1%, the 99% going after the 1%. They not only want to confiscate the 1%'s wealth, they want to make them suffer.
Yeah.
This is really brilliantly written, and we'd be well served here to linger a bit longer, especially within the context of trying to understand Moab, which is why we're here. The common denominator between multicultural, socialist, secular humanism, and Pauline Christianity is an aversion to being judged, and their adverse response should it occur. underscoring the realization that this text was inspired and prophetic. If you judge the Christian faith, or you act judgmental in among someone who is multicultural and politically correct, yeah, they're going to try to eat you up and spit you out. Now, I think most everyone knows that, because we've talked about it before, that immediately prior to the American and French revolutions, a German Jew named Adam Weishaupt, and if you want to know more about him, read his memoirs illustrating the history of Jacobinism. It's written by Abe Barrow. You got to do a lot of filtering. Abe was a huge proponent of Roman Catholicism, which really defined that conflict. It was the Roman Catholic Church versus the socialist secular humanists. And it was quietly fought and won to sever the relationship between church and state, undermining the Roman Catholic Church's ability to crown kings and to impose their will on the masses. Unfortunately, they did it in Machiavellian fashion, and so everyone really lost. But knowing that men and women were religious creatures, Weishaupt advanced the Pauli notions of what we know today as socio-secular humanism, along with its new moral code, which has come to be called political correctness. Using a Machiavellian approach where less than ideal means were justified to achieve the end result, and realizing that the agenda was selfish and flawed as the one that they sought to replace, Weishaupt advanced Paul's plan to obfuscate criticism by punishing and ostracizing those who dared do so. And that's exactly what happens today. If you run afoul of political correctness, you are ostracized and punished, just as you would have been at any of the time that the Roman Catholic Church reigned supreme throughout Europe. Being judgmental, exercising good judgment, has always been the ultimate crime. Now, Weishaupt's dream was realized today in our multicultural, socialist, secular, humanist societies in the West. Should a politician, cleric, educator, business person, or celebrity say anything that runs afoul of either Paul, what he wrote, or what is considered politically correct, they are stripped of their job in the process of being publicly disgraced. There is no defense, no evidence or reason, not even truth. And there is no forgiveness. More than anything else, and this is the reason our world today has come to mirror what we're witnessing in Sodom. Now, to focus a moment longer on Christianity. Rather than address those who would expose their faith as unworthy of their souls, the faithful universally resort to character assassination, deploying the ad hominem fallacy, as was the case with Paul. I mean, even with the conspiratorial types, when I go out of my way to say, I don't want you commingling my translations and insights and transliterations of Yahweh's words with the sites that promote such stupid ideas, their response is always to slander me. They can't refute the arguments. They can't make a rational claim for their false flags of, you know, government actors actually carrying out the mass shootings for God knows what reason, or chemtrails or whatever it is. So all they do is squabble among themselves and use the ad hominem argument. It's always been the case. But, you know, it hasn't always been this way with Christians, because prior to the modern era, prior to the influence of the secular society, the church broke down the doors of the homes of those who would dare criticize them. They would incarcerate and then torture the critics to silence their voice, dissuade others from following their example. And it all began with Paul's first epistle to the Galatians. When he condemned Peter and then denounced the Torah, he undermined the chosen people's ability to criticize him in return. Many of Paul's epistles open with the false prophets demanding that the people who had rejected him listen and change, demeaning them, harassing an entire community for challenging the absurdity of his claims, including Galatia, Corinth, Thessalonica, and Ephesus. His attacks on the apostles Shimon, Jacob, and Yohanan were personal and ruthless. As a result of the political and religious, the patriotic, and those who support their military, the conspiratorialists, and those who are politically correct, are universally resistant to being judged. Truth is deflected, as are evidence and reason. And it's not just the fact that the religious and political, the conspiratorial and the politically correct, the patriotic and the pro-military are adverse to being openly assessed and evaluated. They universally attack and demean those with the comprehension, compassion, and courage to do what love's doing. Words articulated truthfully, supported by evidence and reason, are the Achilles heel of all manner of human contrivances, which is why those who promote religious beliefs, political ideas, conspiracy theories, patriotic platitudes, economic policies, military appreciation, or multicultural agendas, just like Sodomites, are universally opposed to the likes of Lot. They will collectively assure that those who dare exercise good judgment to expose the truth are attacked and scared away. The reaction is always swift and inclusive, just as it was here in Sodom. The citizens of Sodom immediately rose up to silence Lot. They wanted to speak right over him. They sought to move him out of the way, break down his door, get what they want, and make everyone who stood in their way suffer. Now, if we were to distill all that we have learned over the past 18 years together into a single thought, it might well be that we have to think our way to God. He is unknowable and unapproachable to those unwilling or unable to exercise good judgment. And so if you're Hasatan, what are you going to go after?
The ignorant and lazy.
Right. You're going to do everything you can to keep anyone from exercising good judgment, to make exercising good judgment to be right about the facts and reason and evidence extraordinarily painful and costly. So you dissuade people from doing it. You know, most people just go along because the price to stand up and do the right thing is higher than they want to pay. God is unknowable and unapproachable to those unwilling or unable to exercise good judgment. The problem with Sodom. Worse, after hypocritically and irrationally condemning Lot for the very thing they were doing, the Sodomites proceeded such that their way, and only their way, would be considered acceptable. In Sodom, as was the case with Christians and socialist secularists, truth is unacceptable, as are those who convey it. What they missed, of course, in all of this was the opportunity to learn, to grow, to know God. They missed the very thing few men find, the doors. You know that the doors have been the focus of this story all along. Lot's home represents the covenant. The only family Yahweh is concerned about inside that whole moral morass of Sodom. Oh, you can count the number of doors. There were seven of them. There were seven of them. You know what's interesting is I wrote that before I counted the number of doors. It was just obvious that I'm not going to go ahead and correct that. There were seven of them. The first one, Shahar, was in 19:1. Now, I need to go back, and we're going to talk about them, but there really were seven. But it was obvious there was going to be seven doors. And every time we turned around, he was talking about a door. First one, Ishar, was in 19:1, where we find Lot sitting in Sodom's doorway, eager to engage Yahweh's Moloch. I suspect it represents the portal out of Sodom and into the Promised Land. Let's call it Sukkah. There were two in 19:7. Because, by the way, the Sioux could be the one that stands alone because all of the others were attributable to Lodes' home. There were two in 1907 where Lodes went out of the Patak door of his home and then shut the last door behind him, telling the sodomites that they were wrong. Since it appears that the doorways are presented in the reverse order for the backwards perspective of those lost in Moab, of multiculturalism and the backwards nature of Christianity, where they read the book from in the beginning. The door which was opened was Teruah, because it is always appropriate to expose errant thinking. However, the opportunity for reconciliations had been closed on them. The Dileth the Sodomites attempted to break down in 1909 represents Teruah. They would not receive the enrichment, empowerment, or enlightenment they sought. That's particularly germane for those seeking to find Moab in this story. Wesop claimed enlightenment was the path to empowerment for social, secular humanists, and Christians have claimed every one of the covenant's enrichments and benefits for themselves. The final three are presented in this next statement, with one found in 1910 and two in 1911. The delay throughout, or through which they could not pass the Patak, which they could not perceive, the Patak which was impossible for them to find or obtain, represent Pesach, Matzah, and Makorim. It's also telling that there were three distinctly different words for door, just as the Mikre are celebrated three distinct times of the year.
Brilliant.
You know, it's God's consistent. You know, when we began that ark story and we realized there were three doors in the ark, every time we turn around, God's talking about doors. They're open and closed. And the single most poignant door for me, I guess we all have different things that resonate within us. But the door that will probably always be the most poignant for me is when Yeshayah is invited up to heaven. He's entered God's home. And while he's there, God opened the door to his home.
Yeah.
And there was no one, not a single person, standing outside wanting him. Not one person. And Yeshayah essentially breaks down. He feels, you know, so much remorse. He thinks that God's going to, and rightfully would blame him. And you know, he said, I'm so sorry. I should have done a better job. It wasn't Yeshayah's fault. It wasn't God's fault. It was the fault of religion and politics and conspiracy and all the things that man makes up to hide the doors. But to think what God must have felt to reveal all of this, all of these doors to us, and make such a sacrifice to enable us to pass through them, and no one there. You know, I teased everybody and said, you know, there is a second coming, but everybody's been looking to wrong Messiah. You think about Dode for a moment, and you realize that, okay, Dode had his moments, he was brilliant, his psalms are so inspiring, so uplifting, so beautiful, and some of Dode's passion and what he did in life is just so remarkable. But here's God saying, this man is right. This man is so right, so vindicated, so correct, so beloved by me, that I'm going to make him king of the millennial kingdom. And yeah, I told you the story about Yahweh was my father, had to lecture Dode. You know, what's wrong with you? Why are you so emaciated? You know, you love what you should hate. You hate what you should love. Get out of here. Speak from the heart. Shake this off. And so here's the person God's gone out of his way to say, he's right. I love him. He's my son. I'm his father. And even he was so disappointing so much of the time. You know, I can't speak for you fellows, but I can speak for me. I love what we do here, and I love the discoveries that, like this, the seven doors. But, you know, if we were honest, I'd just a total disappointment to God. Should be. Should, you know, so much more should be expected. You know, there we are. God created us because he wanted a relationship. He knew what he was getting, and it's hard to imagine, but we're the best he could find.
I don't mean to say it loud. I mean, it's like, oh, God.
It is. You just got to laugh at it. So the individuals, the spiritual messengers, reached out with their hands. And they brought the load back inside the house, and they said to him, to them, and shut the door. They shut the door. And the men who were out at the entrance to the house, they were struck with blindness, both insignificant simpletons, all the way up to those who were older with status, who were deemed powerful and important, such that they all became weary without the capacity to find the door.
Well,
you know, I think that's what happened. Yeah, I think that's just what happened.
Yeah.
I think that that such long periods of time passed, and God said, you know, there just isn't any hope that anyone's going to figure this out just for a while. So I don't have to deal with any of this. Let's just realize that no one, that everybody's going to be hit with the stupid stick. No one's going to figure it out. They were struck with blindness. Now, they'd be dead by morning. But I dare say that Sodom is alive and well in modern Moab. Between multiculturalism, socialist secular humanism, and Pauline Christianity, you're dealing with, 4 billion people today?
Minimum.
Yeah, at least 4 billion people today. And of those 4 billion people, 3.999 billion of them are struck with blindness. They're insignificant simpletons.
Yes.
And it doesn't matter if they're the youngest and the dumbest. And by the way, the younger they are, I think the dumber they are today. That didn't used to be the case. We went through a period of time where information was growing so rapidly that it was just amazing how smart somebody could be if they wished to. But now, with social media and political courses, we really have.
That's not the case.
Yeah, walking zombies, the walking dead. Hmm. All the way up to those who are older with status, who are deemed powerful and important, they're blind. They couldn't find the door if God himself opened it for them.
Yeah.
It'd be like those idiots during Easter, the Pope decided that he was going to uncover the stairways that were allegedly brought out of Jerusalem, and they were all climbing them and kissing them, and they, you know, all the little icons on them, and took their children to climb them and kiss them. He couldn't find the doorway. Their life depended on it. Mankind's ability to see even the most obvious things have been so occluded by societal and familial customs, so warped by politics and religion, so truncated with indoctrination, replacing education, and so incapacitated today with political correctness and social or secular humanist conditioning. 99.9999% of the people drawing breath on this planet are blind to the things of God and couldn't find Passover, the doorway to life, even if they ran smack into it and did a nose plant. In other words, in the story of Sodom, we see the world of man today. How many times have we said, Pesach is the doorway to life.
Every time you ever say it, we repeated it.
And we want to take advantage of it. If you or those you love were among them, now you know the doorway to life, the doorway to the covenant, the door to Pesach, to Sukkah, has been closed on everyone, from young to old, the powerful and insignificant, the ignorant and the important. When it comes to leaving this planet with one soul intact and free, it matters not if one was a victim, just going along with the crowd, or one was manipulating the masses. These people were not divided into good or bad. They were not divided into charitable or selfish, moral or decadent, religious or agnostic, smart or dumb, young or old, leaders or followers, rich or poor. With regard to their blindness, they were all the same. All of them. Frankly, the human family is fractured and broken. It's far worse than we are aware, because most people don't share their personal anguish. And I suspect it's that way because the lone prerequisite for the covenant requires us to walk away from our father's home. Not only includes walking away from our country and our religious and political influence in Babel, but let's say our father's house. Then the individual spiritual messengers informed, explaining to Lot the enveloped and intertwined, to sustain and continue testifying, who are you concerned about here? Sons-in-law, sons of yours, your daughters, or anyone whom you are concerned about in the city, you can choose to bring out of this place.
What a wonderful offer that was never taken.
Yeah. Anybody you want to bring out of this place,
take them with you.
That you're concerned about, we'll take them out with us. The Malak messengers are not on the way, and otherwise they would not have asked this question. Furthermore, they are not expressing their desire, as they have no such inclinations, but simply asking Lot his preferences. Their mission was to save Lot, and it was then Lot's decision as to whom he would encourage to come along. For indeed, we're about to destroy this putrid pit of a place, because the outcry has become great against them before Yahweh. And so Yahweh has sent us to annihilate this corruption. So since we're told that Moab equals Sodom, don't we therefore know that Yahweh is going to annihilate the corruption of Moab in the last days?
Mm-hmm. Totally obvious.
And what did the messenger say? They didn't say, yeah, aren't we cute? We have little angel wings on us. We must be really loving. In fact, what we should do is we should pose for Valentine's Day cards, right? As messengers of God, the all-knowing, the all-present, the all-loving, we're here to save everybody.
Save everyone.
No. He's never here to destroy the place. Do you think, therefore, that God's going to try to save the world before he returns?
No. Not so.
We came to annihilate this corruption. Why did they have to annihilate this corruption? Where was Sodom?
Yeah, because it's in the middle of Israel, the land he gave
them. That's correct. It's on the western side of the Dead Sea. This was cancer inside of his home, inside of the body of Israel. That corruption had to be removed. Sodom was a shakoth, a putrid, corrupt, and destructive slime pit, which, if not eradicated, would have infected everything around it, just like any contagious or devastating plague. The conditions which existed in Sodom necessitated removing it from Yahweh's home, and it represents one of the many cases in which the most merciful response is for God to annihilate masses of people before their beliefs and customs killed his children. But let's be abundantly clear. Men do not have a mandate to take another life. In fact, the opposite is true because we have been instructed not to make a habit of killing. Further, we are not responsible for Yahweh's home here on earth or in heaven. He is. And since he gave us life and a home, it is within his purview and jurisdiction to truncate both. Especially if the lives shortened are beyond redemption and those spared are still within reach. Oh, I wish there was some way that I could get that through the thick skulls of those that would run into mosques with guns, of those that would run into synagogues with guns. We do not have a mandate to take anyone's life. God can do as he's fit. He can shorten a life if the life he's shortening has no chance of redemption. And by shortening it, he gives those who have such an opportunity the chance to know him. But we ought not be taking that upon ourselves. We should be limited to wielding words wisely. We don't need any guns. Hey, look, I've done 10,000 interviews, all in my own name. I've had thousands of death threats. Do you know how many times I felt the need to pick up a gun to defend myself?
I would suspect none.
Zero. Now, I'd be within my rights to pick up a gun to defend myself. I wouldn't be to use it for any other reason. And yet I've never done it. Never been inclined to think about it. No reason to. I have a friend that was attacked by two Muslims last week. And that friend asked me to pick up some mace for them. Pepper spray. You know, that, so that the next time that happens, they have a means of keeping the Muslims at bay.
Yeah.
And that is something, even with all that I've done, never even contemplated. You know, why don't you get some?
No.
Don't need it, don't want it. I've got something a lot stronger than mace.
Ruach Kodesh.
You betcha. Now the enveloped and entangled went out, and he said to his sons-in-law, who were to obtain his daughters, which means to receive his daughters. I mean, they were going to ultimately marry his daughters based upon the verbiage here. Get up. You're going to want to get out of this place because Yahweh is going to destroy this corrupting pit of a city. But it seemed like he was jesting at the expense of others from the vantage point of his sons-in-law. Tishak is an interesting word here. It seems like he was just jesting, mocking them. You know, it's when you have a certain point of view, it's very difficult to change it. Americans have been in a world where, you know, each day they have their opportunity to go to work and, you know, send their kids off to school. And they can go to the market and their credit card is accepted. And, you know, they can go to the gas station, put gas in their car, and, you know, they turn the key, it will drive. They turn on the internet or the television in the day, and they'll, you know, have their fix of whatever it is they care about. And that has been their normal for all of their lives. It is almost impossible for them to imagine what's going to happen. The idea of America really being bankrupt and the currency having no value whatsoever, of the military being counterproductive, of the collapse of the society, of wars that devastate the planet. Of God intervening on behalf of Israel. These are things that are so far beyond their imagination, their ability to perceive, that they're just not willing to do it. And they're going to laugh at anybody that says otherwise. There is a statement in the second Mizmor where there comes a time that God actually laughs at his creation. Not a laugh like, hey, that was really funny. Boy, you entertained me. No, it was a laugh of disgust. He's talking about the leadership of man and their conspiracies. And just prior to wiping them out, God says, you know, I'm laughing at you in disdain. I'm sitting here mocking you. Not something we're really comfortable putting, projecting on God, but that's what he says. It's hard to blame him. You know, when I was translating them, I kept on thinking if, you know, if I was watching a video of MM leading a suicide bomb manufacturing class, and he had a case of premature detonation, and he killed the would-be killers, I'm going to laugh at the fool. That's, I think, essentially what God is saying. But
yeah.
But here, the son-in-laws have an express ticket to get out of jail to avoid being annihilated. And they say, nah, you're just spoofing with us. We're not going anywhere. We're calcitrant. Now, it's interesting that there's only four people that made it out of Sodom. And one didn't last 5 minutes. She longed for what she left in the last 5 minutes. And we're going to find out that Lot is encouraged to climb up the backside of the Mount of Olives and into Zion and Jerusalem and be with his uncle. But he said, no, I don't want to do that.
That's absurd.
Yeah. He ends up in a place called Lowly and Little. But that doesn't last very long. And retreats to a cave. And where he could have lived in splendor with Abraham, he instead spent the rest of his life in a drunken stupor in a cave, engaging in incest with his daughters. How about a fallen life? I mean, the notion that this is representative of the Christian rapture, you've got to have your head on backwards. So that's the story as we're going to be able to continue to share it. So we're at 1914 now. And it's a great place to stop because as the sun rose, then the spiritual messengers eagerly urged and were adamant with love. Come on, let's get out of here. And we're going to hear all the reluctance of Lot along the way and where he went. And then ultimately why we turn to the story, because it speaks of the birth of two characters that are very, very big players in end of the world prophecy, particularly Moab. But actually, Ben Ammi, the man which became Amon. So we're about ready to find out the reason we've been taken here. And then there's so many other insights as to what Moab represents. And Moab is so important to us today to identify it, because God's going to treat Moab exactly as he did Sodom. And so it's really important that we continue to drill down and find out what God has to say about the modern manifestation of Moab. And then somewhere I'm going to break down. Yeah, I know somewhere I'm going to break down and talk about the second coming, but maybe we'll have to devote a whole program to it.
And the third?
Second and third Mizmor.
Second and third, okay.
And particularly if you take the most surprising line of the second Mizmor, which Yahweh says, you know, on this day. He doesn't say what day it is, but on this day, I'm declaring that he is my son, and I'm going to raise him as my father, as his father. And then it talks about what's going to happen, and the first thing that's going to happen is that he inherits everything. Everything. The material realm. Entire earth. All of the land of the Gentile nations, and way beyond any reading this, it's a yikes. Yikes. And then you have to say, well, where else did God speak of this kind of an inheritance? And you turn to Zechariah 9, which is thought to be one of the most important of all messianic passages, and translate that and set it up against the declaration made in Mizmor 2. And I'm here to tell you, there's only one conclusion. And by the way, Mizmor 2 speaks about a Messiah. The Messiah is Dode. So it's it is not the conclusion I thought we were heading to, but it is an amazing bit of prophecy as we discover Mizmor 2 and 3 and how they interact with other statements that Yahweh made about the second coming. Who would have thought?
Yeah.
Yeah, who would have thought there really is a second coming? It's just
you're
the actual Messiah, the one that's going to be coming. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it tells you Israel to rejoice.
That,
your king is
returning. I got to go, and I got a baby girl wanting me to come sing her night song.
That's wonderful. I've got my baby girl who is 4 foot, who is not only sound asleep, but dreaming with the paws, you know, twitching.
So, yeah, I know that too.
I broke her away from her love interest earlier today, so she's all miffed at me. This daughter across the street she's crazy for the daughter across the street. But, oh well, stuff happens, huh?
Yep.
I'm not gonna have my dog.
I'll talk to you guys next week.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really
all right.
Okay. Bye, bye, David.
Good night. Hello. Yeah. Good night.
Hello.
Good night, Kirk. We'll pick it up right here as the sun rose.
All right. All right.
And let's hope that Terry continues to fight her infection without antibiotics successfully, and that you get your eyes back.
You take care, and next week I have for
you. Yeah, what I'll do is I'll shoot you the first chapter of the second volume. It's a little bit disheveled in the sense that I started it originally at Yirmiyah 48, thinking I was just going to pick up the story with Moab.
Uh-huh.
And then I realized, you know, that's really not the place I need to start in volume 3. Because the neck is Dode's words. This is all about Dode. And so I said, you know what, I'm going to start with the first 7 Mizmor. And so you're going to see that my beginning of 48 is tucked in there, but that's probably going to be chapter 4 by the time I get to it. And I've just started with the Mizmor, and there's more commentary on these Mizmor than probably anything else I've ever written, because there's so many insights to be gleaned.
Oh, well, I mean, my gosh. And I say to you, like what you said earlier, is in all these years, all of these paid professionals, and no one even secretly discovered it and wrote another book on the side just to say, you know, and nobody ever...
Yeah.
Even the note, they didn't find any notes where they had figured it out. Or I found that just extraordinary.
That just think of all the idiots out there who have claimed to have these unique and profound insights, the secret knowledge.
Secret knowledge, mystery religion.
And not one of them buttressed their secret insights with, oh, by the way, this came from God himself. This is what he said. This is really empowering. I mean, the real insights are there for all of us, and they are tremendously empowering, enlightening, uplifting, It's verifiable. Yeah, why would you want the rubbish?
Yeah. I mean, this is just better than ice cream. Are you kidding?
It is better than ice cream.
Wow.
Well, yeah. I agree with you. It's better than ice cream. And it's all there. And just all you have to do is just be open to it. And open to it, though, you know, it's like I translated the second Mizmor. And boy, it seemed obvious to me we were talking about the second coming. And yet I just said, no, I can't go there. And then I get to the third Mizmor, and I'm saying, I got to go back there. It's undeniable. And so you end up, so part of doing this is, well, then you've got to spend another day going back and correcting what you wrote. You didn't give it proper credit.
Yeah.
But it's okay.
Sure.
It's okay.
Look at what you gain every time you dig a hole. I mean, you just turn over the ground.
That's right.
And go, wow.
Oh, my.
Wow.
Yeah, wow.
Wow, thank
you. Just till the ground and think about it.
Yeah.
You know, like I thought that the Absalom story that I shared would completely discredit the conclusion that came on the third Mizmor. You know, what in the world is Dode just being all, you know, so concerned about the uprising from his son? And boy, the more he dug into that, the more he realized, wow, no, and rather than taking us away from it, it's underscoring it.
Yeah, Absalom wanted to kill him. And he went to the Benjamite part of the town on top of it when he left.
Yeah. And he wanted to kill him.
He couldn't do anything. He didn't do anything right.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, Dode is comes back into the land across the Jordan, the Jordan River. Mm-hmm. You know, it's where the children of Israel entered the promised land.
It's Gilgal
of all places. It's exactly the same place. And Gilgal is of course, inseparable from Yosha, as is the Jordan River. Yeah.
Fabulous. I mean, fabulous. You're going to have to ask him, how did you come up with all this?
It's such a beautiful story, so well told, so interwoven with insights.
Yeah. Well, hopefully my eyes will recover by midweek, and I can look up even more and more, so I'm really excited.
Yes, it's good stuff, Shalom.
Thank you.
Well, good night. Shabbat Shalom.
Good night. Shalom, Shalom. Shabbat Shalom.
Best of Terry.
Okay, I will. Thank you very much.